clearing binders full of stuff.
Well, now in terms of covering ground, let's see if I can do a little more about keeping my promises here than I've done so far tonight. There you are. Okay. Oh, we'll stay till midnight.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
All right, chapter 3. Chapter 1 and 2 establish God's claims on the covenant devotion of man. And now chapter 3 tells us what God required under the covenant. What were the covenant stipulations? That third major section, remember, in the ancient treaties, the stipulations. And the subject is going to be divided here primarily in terms of the functions that man was given to perform as a king and the functions he was given to perform as a priest, his cultural task and also his cultic task, of which we've suggested some things already. By way of introduction, I make a couple of points which we can hit very fast. Just as general principles of covenantal behavior, man was made, we've seen, as the image of God. An image and son are very much the same idea, so he's an image and a son. And both of these things imply a likeness. The image is the likeness of the original, the son is the likeness of the father. And if you're the likeness of the original, then you should be imitating God. So the imitation of God, the ways of God, especially as God revealed his ways in creation and his providential control of things, this pattern must be imitated by man. So the principle of the imitation of God is a general principle that describes covenantal duty. And then secondly, these two features of image and son, both describe things which are secondary and subordinate. The image is subordinate to the archetype. The son is under the authority of the father. And so a second general principle of man as the image bearer and the son is he has this under authority, subordinate position. He's in the position of a servant. And he should be rendering the service of love to his God and Father, which comes to expression in general things like thou shalt worship the Lord thy God and him only shalt thou serve, or thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and mind and with all thy strength. These are formulations of some general principles, the imitation of God and the service of love and emphasizing that then under the, especially the idea of love, that this general principle is of love is not one then that you substitute for specific commandments. That's not the biblical idea of the love of God, but love for God comes to expression precisely in your obeying the several, indeed the many specific commandments that he spells out. If you love me, you will keep my commandments, Jesus said, and likewise Moses, who expresses the idea that they should love the Lord, spells out the way they show that love in terms of submission to the many specific requirements, covenants, stipulations. So those are a couple of general comments. We'll be picking up on the idea of the imitation of God principle and showing how that works itself out in some detail when we come to look at the cultural task. And so on page 42 now and following, we go on from the general principles to analyze I call it here the theocratic kingdom commission. Man is placed in a theocracy, in that kind of a holy kingdom, with a task to perform, with a commission. And part of that will be the very specific task having to do with his probationary role, which will be the way in which he earns the right ultimately to glorification in heaven. Other requirements anticipate what his historical role will be beyond probation and before glorification and so on. So there's a variety of things involved here, the Theocratic Kingdom Commission. Now we'll be dealing, as I said, then with priestly tasks and with royal tasks, with cult. I keep using the word cult, and I guess by now you see the way I'm using it, not in terms of little isolated groups that have strange ideas, and most of them live in Southern California. But they're not here.
Migrated north.
Some of them did. We're talking simply about that aspect of our life, which is our vertical relationship to God, where we express worship and love and devotion directly to God. And that's what I'm talking about as cult. And then culture is the way in which at the horizontal level we relate to the rest of creation and subhuman, as well as our own peers as human beings. And the point I make here, and by way of introduction, is that both cult and cultural activities all are religious. Everything you do is religious. Now, a moment ago we were saying that within a theocracy, cult and culture, everything is holy. So obviously that they would be religious. Everything is holy there. It's when you get outside of the theocracy, after the fall, when you're in this common grace situation, where, of course, cultic activity as engaged in by God's holy people, that of course is what we would think of as religious. But now, what about that non-holy cultural activity that you engage in common grace? Now, my point here is that too is religious. It's not holy, but it is religious. It's religious because it is the Lord who tells us to engage in these cultural vocations and these non-holy vocations. They're not evil, they're just non-holy. It's the Lord who tells us to engage in those things, just as he is the one who tells us to engage in worship. And it is unto the Lord that we perform those cultural functions, those secular, non-holy cultures. Everything we do is unto the Lord. And so we never get away from that connection. We always have that relationship. We live in before the eyes of God and unto his glory, and no matter what we do. And so everything is religious, and we don't divide our life into a religious and a non-religious area. So part of it God's involved with and part God's not involved. We have to do with God at every point. So that's a simple point to make. I am misunderstood, I think, sometimes as when I talk about culture being non-holy, suggesting that it's not religious. That's not my position. Everything is religious. Then the second introductory thing is just reminding us, you know, we talk about special revelation and natural revelation, and do we sometimes think that you have a special revelation only after after there's a need for redemption? And that, of course, is not the case. There's a need for special revelation even from the beginning. And so pre-redemptive special revelation is something that we should be aware of. So along with natural revelation of the power and the wisdom and the divinity of God that you have in creation out there and in the conscience and so on, the sense of deity within, along with the natural revelation that was there right from the beginning, there was special revelation. God's, the thing we've been talking about, the presence of God on the holy mountain, there was a special revelation in theophanic form right there. But in addition to that, we said that the Garden of Eden was the place of oracular words coming, God's special revelation. And there was a particular need for that, because although man would know who God is, and therefore basically what he himself must be like, as he must imitate this God, then nevertheless there were certain things that he would not just know by the law written on his heart. There were certain institutions that God would have to tell him, marriage, how men and women to relate to one another. God sets up this institution of marriage and defines that took special revelation. How is man to observe time? Here is an ordinance, the institution, the family, the ordinance of the Sabbath, the Sabbath weekly structuring of time. These are things that required special revelation that wouldn't have been written on just on man's heart from the beginning. The whole cultural task precisely that we're talking about, how is man know what his historical role, or what's he supposed to do in this big wide world? Well, he has to be told what is to be done there, and what's to come of it all, what's the goal of it all, prophecy, huh? What the ultimate sanctions are, that's the next chapter we'll be coming to. What's the reward of obedience, the punishment for disobedience, the sanctions of the covenant would have taken special revelation. And most especially, I guess, that probationary prohibition, here's a tree, don't eat of it. Wow, he wouldn't have known anything about that from the law written on his heart. This seemed to contradict everything, in fact, written on his heart, or even spoken of by God beforehand. God has said, all these plants you can eat, and now comes this special one, this one you can't. So there's a whole variety of things that required a special revelation even before redemption. Our confessions, when they are speaking about anything like this subject, confine themselves, it seems, just to the necessity for Scripture. Why was scriptural revelation needed? And then, of course, that's only talking about redemptive period afterwards. But this other subject of the necessity for special revelation in general, not just inscripturated, but just orally spoken, the need for that before the fall is not recognized, or even the fact of such revelation is not always recognized, but we should be aware of these things. All right, so there is this special revelation then, and it communicates to man his various duties. And the first one then is his duty as a king. And let's see if we can just hit the high spots on this one. I call it his cultural, you've often with the language of the cultural mandate. We all hear about that as a term trying to describe how even today Christians should be concerned not just with things ecclesiastical, but with have a broader world and life view and so forth. And we talk about the cultural mandate. Well, there certainly was here at the beginning a cultural mandate, a commission, and what was the task? And I suggest here that the task was one of building the city of God. So that they are established right from the beginning in this holy sanctuary, this theocracy, which was, to use another figure, then the God's city. It was his house, it was his kingdom, it was his... It was the city of God, and this city then was to be expanded, and it was to be built up, and it would be built up in terms of several cultural functions, the filling the earth and subduing, okay? And filling is a function of procreation, and subduing it is the whole area of human labor and so on. So the construction of the holy kingdom city, and mind you, it's a holy kingdom city. After the fall, you still have the city, but it's now part of that common grace line. It's not the holy city anymore. And so there is a cultural mandate after the fall under common grace. There is a cultural mandate, but here's where I object to the common use of speaking of the cultural mandate as if there's it's the same one today as it was before the fall. And that's simply not the case. What we are doing today in terms of our cultural functioning as we work together with unbelievers in this world is not building the holy city of God. But the original cultural mandate was to build the city of God, the holy city. And so this is done by... through the procreation function, and that, as we move along, is the one that is placed within the context of marriage as the proper place for that to happen. And then along with that, there is the function of labor throughout the historical genealogical process. Human life would continue to be of the earth, earthy. I jumped ahead a little too fast, you know, when we talk about the filling of the earth is a cultural task, and I'd like to just emphasize that one point. That what is the main cultural product in this whole cultural task? What is the main cultural product? We tend to think in terms of things external to man, but actually man himself, the family of Adam, they are to be produced as part of this cultural procreation marriage, family, function, And man himself is the chief product of this whole cultural history. He is the chief end product of human culture. Genealogy. Genealogy is the primary genre of human history, historiography. We look at the genealogies in the Bible as sort of, you know, little formal, not all that interesting sections here and there. But actually, that's the center story of the whole thing, is the production of this mankind, because it is this mankind who is going to be the holy temple, the holy city of God. And, all right. Then along with procreation, there is the fact that the earth has to be, well, here's the problem of what language to use, because so much debate over just what's going on here, whether the biblical view is the problem with all kinds of bad exploitation of the world and the poisoning of the springs and all this kind of thing. But there is then the way in which here man is a king over the world. And the resources of the world are put at his disposal so that working with them, he can enhance his kingship. He can enhance his kingly dignity and enjoyment of the world and so on. And, you know, he's not yet glorified. His dominion over the world isn't at that stage where it will be when he is glorified, when he won't need the external cultural instruments anymore. But just in the integrity of his own glorified human body, he will have this kind of dominion. Meanwhile, we are of the earth, earthy, and we have to get for ourselves a life support system from the earth. And although there would be the blessing of God on all this effort, it still requires work. And so man is set to work within the world that is lying there, ready to be exploited, if that's not too strong a term. To be utilized in order to bring forth things for man's benefit, as we said, everything being consecrated ultimately to man. So besides availing himself of the earth's hospitality, man would have to protect himself from earth's inhospitable elements and moments. We argue that there were threatening things out there. Southern California has not only weird cults, but it also has beautiful weather. But the whole planet Earth didn't necessarily have Southern California weather from the outset. That might have had North and South poles with all kinds of ice caps and so on. Which, when man ventured into, he'd better have a fur coat on, you know. So he would have to protect himself from the otherwise inhospitable, threatening features of the world, but always under the blessing of God, and things would have gone fine, and he wouldn't have gotten frostbite, what was necessary. He would have been provided with. Now, when the Bible is describing that, one word that it uses, as I suggest here, is this word kavash, which we often translate to subdue, or to mean to take possession of, or to occupy. Here is a term that God uses. You are to exercise dominion over the world and to subdue it. And that's the particular word that is seized upon by critics of the biblical worldview, and saying, look, here is this biblical Christian view of things, and it's because we are going about trying to subdue the world that we are cutting down all of the rainforests and doing everything else to poison the atmosphere and so on, and that's the fault of the biblical concept of subduing the world. Well, of course, when these poisoning of the springs and the atmosphere and all this takes place, this is not following the biblical mandate. What's going on here? What's the basic idea? What is the cultural mandate all about? It's for the enhancement of man's dignity and enjoyment as a king over all the world. And when you destroy your very environment around you, that is not enhancing your enjoyment of the world, quite the contrary. So the mandates that are given to subdue the earth have to be understood compatibly with the purpose of it all, which is for the ultimate benefit of a man. And this is balance of things is suggested somewhat by the fact that along with kavash, to subdue, you get the other Hebrew term avad, which means to serve. Yeah, now the earth is serving man, and yet strikingly, man must serve the earth. He must make use of it in such a way that he is cultivating the earth, huh? at the same time that he is serving his own interests. And it is in the balance of those two things that we have the biblical view of it. So fulfillment of man's cultural stewardship would thus begin with man functioning as a princely gardener in Eden. But the goal, or he begins there with the singing, but the goal of his kingdom commission was not some minimal local life support system. The goal was rather a maximal global mastery. The cultural mandate put all the capacity of human brain and brawn to work in a challenging and rewarding world to develop the original paradise home into a universal city. Now that's the goal of it. There you have this original, whatever the size of Eden was, limited area, here to expand that into the global city of God, the kingdom city. Such is the picture that emerges when the design of all that was envisaged in the various assignments of procreation and royal labor are pieced together. And so what are the elements of a city? I suggest is oversimplifying, no doubt, but you have citizens, you have some sort of a fashioning of the materials of the earth into some architectural form that provides a roof and a shelter and other things. And then the third ingredient would be that you have some form of government. Now the citizens of the city are provided by the procreation, fill the earth. The architectural aspect of the city of man, so far as that's this material cultural form to it, is an expression of the laboring to subdue the world and to make it manageable and to protect you from its inhospitable moments and so on. And then the third ingredient will be then the one dealt with in the next paragraph, which is that from the beginning there was a form of government, the city form of government, which was the family structure, because there was no difference. The Holy Family was the citizens of the city. There was no distinction between them. So it's as the one holy covenant community grew, then that the city grew, and the family authority structure would be then just carried over and developed in the polity of the city. So right from the outset, you do have the family institution, and on page 45, I'm pointing out that there, you know, Adam and Eve are created not just a man and a woman; they're created husband and wife. Right from the outset, this is the names that they are given at the creation, names that relate them in terms of marriage or relation. So there is this legal covenantal bond, the oneness between them, which is this institutional family bond that God ordains. And I discussed a little bit of the evidence for the covenantal nature of marriage. It was within this marital relationship of legal troth that the procreation function of the cultural commission was to be fulfilled. The cultural commission then was a family mandate. It was a family mandate, not alone in the sense that it was to be performed by mankind acting as a family. This was not a bunch of lone rangers off on their own doing their thing, this cultural kingdom. But it was the family, as a family, expanding and fulfilling the cultural mandate. But also it was a family mandate in the sense that the goal of the whole thing was the production of the kingdom family. So we may now refine what we said before, as the goal was the city of the royal human family, not just the royal human race, but the royal human family, filling and ruling the earth. That's the goal of the cultural commission. And that family identification of the covenant community remains with us throughout the rest of the scripture. The original covenant family was not without its divinely appointed government. So there is an authority structure here within the family. And that authority comes to expression in the parent-child relationship. So at this point, the later requirement for children to honor their parents would have had a proper place right from the beginning. There was an authority structure there in paradise. And also then, in the middle of page 46, we launched into the thorny subject of the authority structure in the husband-wife relationship. And you can read that, but I take the traditional position that the care of the wife assigned to the husband in the marriage ordinance was attended by an appropriate marital authority, and I give the biblical evidence why that is so. So right within the family authority structure, you within the family community, you do have such an authority structure, and that would have characterized the whole city of God as it moved out. So each family unit then of the branching covenant family would exhibit the marital and the parental authority pattern. The covenant institution as a whole would be the complex of these individual family authority structures. And this is a principle of polity that has proven to be a constant in the determination of the form of the covenant. The total covenant form is made up of individual family units, I'm saying, okay? And I'm also making the Presbyterian is over against Baptistic point now here, that always within the covenant organization, the covenant is made up of family units. That has been the case right from the beginning. Throughout the Old and New Testament ages, the parental authority principle established in the covenant of creation has continued to be honored, and so that those who own the covenant have the privilege and duty of exercising their parental authority to bring their children with them under the institutional role of their Lord in his covenant. So here are some polity features that have a direct relevance for other questions that we're concerned about when we're talking about circumcision, baptism, and their proper recipients later on, the question of who belongs within the covenant. Right from square one, it has always been in terms of families. And as I think we pointed out, that's why the history of the covenant from Adam to Noah in Genesis 5, and the history of the covenant from Noah to Abraham in Genesis 11, that's why these histories of the covenant are cast in the form of genealogies, because they are family histories, because the covenant community is organized as in this genealogical form. Salvation is not guaranteed within these things, but the outward organization of the covenant community is in terms of where God honors the family authority structure when he comes to structuring the redemptive community. And then, of course, along with these other things, there's this peculiar feature in the original covenant of Adam's federal headship position. So here is a feature of that original theocratic city and covenant community where you have the one who is in his probationary activity, representative of the many. And okay. So under the covenant of creation, summing up the top of page 47, the covenant family was the universal cultural authority structure, a royal family with proprietorship and dominion over the whole world environment. This governmental order was headed up in the patriarchal authority of Adam. As we noted above in chapter 2, such governmental structure at the human level was consistent with the theocratic nature of the covenant kingdom, which is to say it's consistent with the ultimate rule of God himself. It's consistent with that because the human government was a vassal authority that acknowledged the supreme authority of God as its absolute head. Man's kingly proprietorship of the earth was a stewardship then. It was a stewardship for which he was accountable to the Lord God. This was ultimately a theocracy. Man has the dignity of a king under God and so on, but it is under God. So there's authority structure here, but it's one which is recognizing the rule of the Lord. God was in truth the ruler and the protector of the family kingdom of mankind. He was their ultimate father. They bore his surname, for he had created them his image, a son. By the way, even in the ancient treaty diplomacy, where they would use the language of the great king and the vassal king, that political model, which makes a valid point as an analogy to God's relationship to his people, that he is king and they are servant. But even those ancient Near Eastern treaties, the suzerain was also called a father. And so the family model, as well as the political model, informed the covenantal model, even in the ancient Near Eastern diplomacy. And of course, it certainly does that within the Bible. So there's no conflict or tension between God as King and God as Father. They both belong to the covenantal concept. Now we come to take the general principle that we started out with, the principle of the imitation of God, and to glance at how that principle applies in working out what we were just talking about, this cultural task of subduing the earth, and filling it and subduing it, building the holy city of God. So page 47 and following, the whole series of areas that I think are helpful to us in developing sort of a Christian philosophy of culture, you know, and what's going on here. How should we think of it? That's not we're all involved in even if we have ecclesiastical callings, huh? So we're very much involved with that holy redemptive line. We were all still involved even after the fall with this common cultural line and how to think about it. And here we're suggesting we should think about it as work, huh? Work as having dignity because it is part of the imitation of God. This is part of our godlikeness, that we are engaged in work, and moreover in the particular kinds of work that we have to do. It's all imitation of God. The fundamental, all right, let's see. Man's offices and functions in relation to the construction of the kingdom city were designed to be a human reflection of the authority and the activity of the Lord God, creator and governor of the world. Now, one expression of the imitation of God principle is found in the very fact that man was called upon to be a worker, like the worker, capital W, of the six creation days. So God is revealed in the very account of creation as the one who works at building the cosmic temple. And he is the great architect, artisan, builder, worker who takes the delight in his work and so on. So God's a worker. We are made in his image to imitate him. Therefore, we are working. And there's the dignity of work, and how much that message then is needed when there are so many tedious, menial, seemingly meaningless tasks that people are called upon to perform. But if they can still see that somehow all of this is a part of the imitation of God, that will add some meaning and zest to their work, hopefully. So man was commissioned to enter into and carry forward the work of God, furthering God's ultimate purpose of glorifying himself by developing the kingdom city as a reflector of the divine glory. Invited to be a fellow laborer with God. That's what it's all about. Invited to be a fellow laborer with God. That's the dignity of man, the worker. Jesus, the second Adam, affirmed his own adherence to the imitation of God principle in this particular respect when he said, "My Father works until now, and I work." See, that's part of Jesus imitating the Father. Now you break it down. What's the nature of that work? Well, God's work was creative. And beyond that, as the God of providence, it was sustaining and governing. And you can take each of those and see how there is something corresponding to them in this cultural task that was assigned to man. God is creative, and we are called upon to be creative. Genesis 5:1 brings this out quite specifically in terms of the procreation function, the bringing forth of children, when it immediately compares the fact that God created a man's son in his own image, and then Adam fathers his son in his own image, and so this procreation activity of man is immediately described as analogous to reflective of God's creative work. And then there is the inventive genius of the inventor, and there is the artistic creativity of the artist, and the different aspects of God, and the wisdom and the beauty that he brings forth are all part of what we are up to. So when you are thinking of, again, as I say, of a Christian philosophy of art or anything else like that, here is a foundational thing that to keep in mind. It's basically part of the imitation of God, who is creative. In man's cultivation of the earth, in his nourishing and nurturing of his own young, his caring for and using, taming and domesticating the animals, in all the variety of cultural laboring to subdue the earth, man was imitating what God did in his providential preserving and governing of the world as a place and so on, all right? Then again, along with the biological and technological aspects, there's the social dimension. And here there's the love of God, which he shows. And there's the fact that God is a covenant-making, and especially God is a covenant-keeping God, huh? That these are things for us to imitate in our cultural life and relating to all kinds of people close and farther afield, showing love to them in all our social relationships and so forth in being covenant keepers and so on. Then there's the whole area of the cultural enterprise. It's not just a matter of brawn, but it's a lot more increasingly as time goes on. It's a matter of brain and information manipulation and so on. There's the whole interpretive process, huh? That becomes part of the cultural advance. And here too, we are imitating God. Naming things is interpreting them, and God is the original namer. He said, let there be, and he gives it a name. Adam, come along now, do this kind of thing. Here are the animals. Be godlike here, assign names to them, and so on. And involve yourself in the interpretive naming process. And much to be said along that line. Stated in terms of cultural office, the man's interpretive vocation, here he is, he's the wise man, huh? That's what we are called upon to be the wise folk. Man's interpretive vocation was a call to the post of the wise man, philosopher, scientist. This was not so much an office in itself as it was an adjunct of man's kingship. As he exercises kingship, it's not just a matter of power, but as we said, it's a matter of having wisdom and knowledge as how to do things. And the wisdom and the wise man is the wise man in the court of the king. So when I think of offices of Adam from the beginning, or mankind from the beginning, he's a king, he's a priest. Wise man is not a third one. Wise man is an aspect of the kingship. And I think a reflection of this is found right within the biblical canon itself, because you look at the wisdom literature itself, and it's so much of it is under the aegis and auspices, if not the authorship of kings like King Solomon and so on. And so wisdom is an aspect, you see, of our kingship. Summing up on top of page 49, viewed broadly then, the Cultural Commission was a program to actualize that dominion which was central to man's image likeness to the glory spirit. Man's culture was to provide a human replica of the divine kingship manifested in the glory archetype. Man was invested with a godlike authority and majesty, and he was charged, in imitation of God, to perfect the consecration of the world to his own royal use and honor. And of course, in doing so, he would be building the holy city of God, which was to the honor of the Lord. Now we come to one other aspect of it, which we'll deal with at a little more length here, because it is one, again, that is much discussed in all kinds of different opinions. And debated and thorny subject, and perhaps along with the creation days, the subject of the Sabbath form of culture that we're going to be talking about, along with the creation days, is maybe the second most debated, disputed issue in terms of our commitment to the details of the confession and so on. So let's look at it here, and it's point four, page 49. Here are various ways we've suggested in which man's cultural life imitates God, but now there's this, the most conspicuous thing in the whole picture. Is the way in which the temporal structuring of our cultural life is said to be an imitation of God. Here, the whole thing is very explicit. Maybe some of these other points you've made, you see, are there, but they're not as explicit. But here, it's absolutely explicit. God, cultural activity, if you will, his kingdom-creating activity, all unfolded as he describes it in Genesis 1 in a sabbatical pattern of 6 days work with crowned by the seventh day of rest, that day of consummation and consecration to the Lord and so on. And God now takes his way and he imposes it as an ordinance on human beings. Fill the earth, subdue it. It's going to take a long time. Generations are going to go by before all of this is accomplished, before the earth is filled, before you come to the day of glorification. And as you make your journey from here to there, your life, your time is to be structured sabbatically. And so here is an ordinance that will bring that out, and that will be an expression of the imitation of God. So that's the point we're making now. The imitation of God principle was to find embodiment, first of all, in the overall pattern of history of man's kingdom labor. Now here I'm not talking just about the weekly ordinance yet, but I'm talking about the total structure of human history as envisaged from the beginning. Fall or no fall, this is the way it was to be from the beginning, that mankind was not created in some state that was to be static and unchanged, but eschatology is there right from the word go. God created the world as an eschatological situation in eschatological movement to consummation. His own creation activity also already had that eschatological direction. It was moving toward the Sabbath. And man is made in the imitation of God, and therefore human history will be like creation history. It will be an eschatological movement. It isn't that you have a certain situation created first, and then later on you get some eschatology tacked on. No. Right from the outset, it has this eschatological direction to it. It has the glorification goal there, which has to be won. Therefore, there has to be a probation. There has to be a works covenant that will be fulfilled and earn heaven at last. And so the overall history of mankind from the beginning, as he being the image of God, was one that would be sabbatical in the sense that it was on its way toward a Sabbath goal from the beginning, the consummation of paradise and so on. So mankind's cultural endeavors were to move forward to and issue in a sabbatical rest. In fact, man was to come by way of these works at last into God's own royal rest, as we studied in Hebrews 4. Now, as human history has turned out, it is through Jesus, the second Adam, that God's people actually find their way into the realm of the Sabbath rest. It is he who leads them into the true and eternal Canaan, the new Eden. But this redemptive accomplishment of the second Adam illumines the design of the program originally assigned to the first Adam. Like redemptive history, the history of the covenant of creation was to be characterized by an eschatological thrust and direction. It was to have a sabbatical structure. This eschatological sabbatical nature, which the history of man had from the beginning, was a consequence of the very fact that man was created in the image of the Sabbatarian creator. Entering into the kingdom program as God's servant son, man was to reflect the divine glory, advancing through his 6 days of work, as it were, to the seventh day of completion. He was to advance from kingdom development to a Sabbath of joyous shalom, peace. Now, here's the overall pattern of human history. It's going to be, in the general sense, one of work, completing the cultural task, fill the earth and subdue it. Work, issuing and Sabbath rest. Now, what God does is he takes this whole big pattern and he stamps it across the days of man's earthly existence in the form of the Sabbath ordinance, so that the overall pattern is repeated and symbolically, prophetically set before man's eyes, so that he makes his journey through his long history, and the trail is blazed all along the way by the Sabbath sign, you know, every seventh day, pointing to the ultimate seventh rest. And so there is now the ordinance of the Sabbath, and appointed by the Lord from the beginning, and a man's cultural life is structured temporally. It's structured by this pattern. So we now have to do then with the Sabbath ordinance. And what is its origin? Who are the proper observers of it? How is it to be observed? On some of these positions, my own some of these questions, my own position is the traditional one. At other points, it is not so traditional. And so here is a place where you all become Bereans and search the scriptures whether these things be so or not. And if they are, you follow them. And if you don't find them there, you don't follow them. But here's how the professor of the occasion sees these issues. On the first point, as to the origin of the Sabbath, I follow the traditional view that it is a creation ordinance. It is not some ordinance that comes along later, let's say when God's dealing with Israel, for the first time he appoints the Sabbath there, and that what we find in Genesis 1 is really looking ahead to that. No, I think the biblical evidence is indeed that the Sabbath ordinance was one that God appointed to Adam right there at the beginning, and I tried to make out something of a case for it, which